Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. What we need to do is not look back to jobs. It's old news. You know, we all know that. It's like ancient news, and we're always looking forward here at Surveillance. Let's do that on the labor economy and on the view forward with Carl Riccadonna, Chief U.S. Economist at BNP Paribas Markets 360. Carl, I want to slice, and you do this in your research note, you slice and dice the confusion that's out there. I think the financial media is way too simplistic about the labor reports, plural. And the debate Friday, was it a good report or a bad report? Which part of the complexities of labor matter to this confusion? Was it a good report? Was it a bad report?
I would say it was a good report, not a great report, and not as strong as the headline would have you believe, because when we start parsing into the details, not only was there a big negative net revision to the prior right. 2 months, you should lop that off of the top line, also the decline in the work week. So one-tenth decline in the work week is equivalent to about 200,000 jobs. So you take that off of the number, and you're really talking about a labor market that is showing signs of weakness. So we have all these different labor gauges.
Right.
What I think we need to do, because the most important thing is the take-home pay for workers. And when we look at that number in aggregate, we can absolutely see that the trend is decelerating. It's heading below the rate of inflation at the moment. And so this is a big problem for households. The rocket fuel for consumer spending is coming in a dramatically slower fashion going forward. And that has right. big implications for how consumers look later this quarter and especially into next year.
And part of this is the microeconomics foundations of this. You were so fortunate at Princeton to have a guy named H. Rosen, Harvey Rosen, held court on look at the minutia. You do that in your research note. You're doing Harvey Rosen 101, and you're saying look at labor supply. What is the distinction of the American labor supply right now?
The supply simply isn't there, and it's not just a story of early retirements. It's happening across a broad swath of the labor base, and this tells us there's less slack than meets the eye, and if we're printing jobs at a pace of 200,000 plus per month, this is continuing to amp up the pressure in the labor market, and we saw that in the latest average hourly earnings
Neil
numbers.
That's not bury the lead.
Not to correct you on air, but I think it's Harvey Rosen 102, not 101.
Okay, excuse me.
Let's not bury the lead. How far is this Fed going to go? Because I know the BNP call is a little bit out there compared to maybe the consensus.
Sure. Well, it is now. We'll see what happens after the press conference next week. But we do think that there's another 50 basis point tightening in December. We expect another 50 basis points in February and then finishing it off at 25 bips at the March meeting. So we're at a terminal rate of 5.25, consistent entirely with what we're seeing in terms of the upward surprises on labor, GDP, consumer spending. We're slowing, but we're not slowing quite fast enough, so the Fed has a bit more work to do.
Dr. Riccadonna, it's like take two aspirin. He doesn't talk the same as when he was here.
You mean he's quicker?
He's
sharper.
Quicker. He's like,
so let's get
this,
to work.
This.
When can I go home? Can I go back to the office now? Is there upside risk to that call? What's the balance of risk around that call?
I think it's a pretty balanced risk at this point in time. But, the story has been over the last few months, the resilience in the labor market. So we jokingly put a subtitle in our write-up of the jobs report, more Rocky Balboa than Rocky in terms of the labor market.
Stallone.
You know, oh, Rocky, the boxing.
I think Rocky Balboa.
Got
it.
Philadelphia.
This is wasted on you, isn't it?
It's Philadelphia talk.
I haven't seen the movie, actually.
But the point is that continually upset the
not
prices,
true.
Whether it's retail sales, labor data, GDP figures, et cetera, et cetera. So, the Fed is going to keep at it until the job is done, and the latest data suggests they may have to keep at it a little bit more than previously anticipated.
Are we seeing a shift from Chairman Powell from the news conference to Brookings? What did you think about that?
I don't think we're seeing a shift. Just because he didn't talk about financial conditions, the point you were highlighting earlier today on the program, there's a big difference between where we are now compared to where we were between the July FOMC presser and the Jackson Hole speech, where he ripped up the script and delivered this very hawkish message. We see a turn happening in the inflation numbers. We see that the housing sector is slowing down. We see the impact of a stronger dollar and tighter rates in the factory sector and in manufacturing. So the Fed feels less behind the curve at the moment, and so there's less need to aggressively run out and try to stage manage financial conditions. Instead, they can let the markets react to the signaling from the updated dot plot and summary of economic projections.
I'm going to move to the 9 o'clock hour, looking at different things with Stephen Roach, and I want to start with him with wage spiral. Help us out here. Define what a wage spiral is as it slips into our conversation.
Well, wage price spiral is when workers are demanding higher wages to keep up with inflation, but those higher wages are then providing the fuel and the funding to sustain those price increases. It's too early to say that we're in that dynamic at the moment because the economy is undergoing a massive deceleration, right? If we look at real GDP, it was about 13% year-on-year in the middle of last year. It was 6% at year-end, about 2% middle of this year. It's heading close to zero this year. So with that kind of deceleration, you know that the wage trend is going to decelerate as well. And therefore, there's a good chance that we break this dynamic before a real deleterious feedback loop comes about.
How is it broken? What's the actual, your study of history and how we act? Do we have wages deflate or do they
We won't
just
have wages
ebb?
Deflate, but we, what will happen is that as the labor market starts to loosen up, then you'll see that bargaining power quickly eroded from U.S. workers. So we're not there yet. We're printing north of 200,000 on jobs. But I think by the first quarter of this year, we could very well see our first negative payroll print. And then loosening starts to come about, we are in the recession camp for next year, probably starting in Q2. That loosening of labor conditions as the unemployment rate moves from a low of 3.5 towards 6% at the peak, that will erode the bargaining power and prevent the feedback loop from occurring.
So that's the trajectory for growth. Can you give us the glide path for inflation, maybe a sneak peek of next week and beyond?
Sure. Well, the first bit is easy. So getting to 8% CPI to 4 is something that can probably happen in about 2 or 3 quarters. Getting from 4 to 2 is the hard part. And so, that requires the rent story to change meaningfully. And also, really, the core inflation metric we have to be watching at the moment is core services ex rents. And not to be too cute, but now we have to strip out medical services as well because of this accounting dynamic related to insurance payments and COVID and whatnot. So if you look at that component of the CPI, that's where you watch for your wage price spiral dynamics.
Interesting.
And we're seeing no improvement on that front yet, right? So that tells the Fed they have to keep hammering away at the problem. It's easy to get from 8 to 4. From 4 to 2 probably takes till about the end of 2024.
So this is a question more along the lines of a reaction function question on the Fed.
Yes.
So if I put the two pieces together, you've got growth, recession, inflation kind of sticky, difficult to get from 4 to 2. Is the Fed holding interest rates at your 5.25 as the economy rolls into
They're
recession
going to have
and inflation's
to hold it
at
there
4?
For a much longer period of time, John, and this is something that the markets haven't fully come to appreciate. Powell teased this in the November press conference when he said shift away from the pace to the level and the duration. The market has refocused to the level, but I don't think they've fully incorporated the duration, and the Fed won't be the white knight riding to the rescue as it normally is in a recession. Instead, the Fed, we expect to stay at this 5.25 level basically for the entirety of next year, and they could start easing, but not moving into accommodative territory in 2024.
Okay, this is sacrilege at BNP Paribas, a very conservative shop, but the zeitgeist now is Oleg Korenko at Virginia Commonwealth University over to the giant Olivier Blanchard at the Peterson Institute, which Paul Krugman wrote about 4 or 5 days ago, of the new 2%. As you mentioned, 4% is a challenge. The new 2% is going to be elevated out in the vicinity of 3%. Can we withstand that? Is, you know, that theoretical chit chat of people like you, can we withstand a new inflation level above 2%?
It's going to be hard to get to that 2% level. And I know there's a lot of discussion right now. I'm fielding lots of questions. Why not change the inflation target? And the Fed officials, presidents and governors alike, are of the same view that we have to achieve 2% to prove that we can hit the 2% target. If there is a time to relax the inflation threshold and whatnot, they have to do it from the other side of the new threshold. And so they have to get to 2%, prove we can stay there. If they have a compelling reason because of demographics or energy costs or otherwise, they would then need to maybe reevaluate what the longer term target could be. They can do that, but you can't do that when you're this far off of the target to the high side.
Party at Carl's Saturday morning.
Football.
France, England.
And now you're at BNP, do you have to pretend to like the World Cup?
We.
Just fluent French now as well.
Babble and dual English.
Do you walk around with French flags supporting the national team? Is that how it works? Just that's it. That's
it. I'm only on
If you seriously never, can we clear this up? Because people want to know. Have you never watched Rocky?
I have honestly never watched the movie.
You've never watched Rocky?
It was a show.
John, this is where I walk off set.
What? TK.
Come with me, John.
What? Seriously? You've never watched Rocky?
No.
I'm leaving with Carl.
It's painful. You are leaving with Carl.
I'm leaving with Carl. Have you never watched Rocky? Has that even happened?
I don't know.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Let's do this right now. And we really thank Rebecca Patterson for being with us with Bridgewater. She had every reason to cancel after the shock last week of their performance. She is the chief investment strategist for Bridgewater, which was doing so better than good and ran into challenges. Rebecca, without getting into the nitty-gritty of Bridgewater, what were the challenges you faced in the last 90 days?
Well, we take views that are usually 6 to 18 months out. And so as we're looking at the world, we continue to be quite cautious on assets. We think that the market is discounting Goldilocks, that the Fed is going to be able to start easing in the second half of next year without any material hit to earnings and only a very moderate slowdown in the economy. And we just don't think that adds up. And so as we've seen this bear market rally in recent months, the market responding to increased hope that the Fed will pause and then start actually cutting rates next year, we have seen growth assets, risky assets performing well. But we still believe that as we go into 2023, while there is going to be this tug of war, how much will the Fed accept inflation versus force inflation to its target? How much growth pain will we get? We continue to believe that there's another shoe that has to drop, and that is the economy. It's resilient today still, with the exception of housing. But we think the Fed is going to have to push demand lower to get that wage inflation down.
Right.
And they're not likely to ease next year.
With your years at J.P. Morgan, Bessemer, and now with Bridgewater, tell us about the dollar as the litmus paper of the system. Suddenly weak dollar. Did that diminish the Bridgewater total return and lead to those quarterly losses? And what is a weaker dollar signal now?
Well, the dollar, as you said, has been giving up a lot of its gains from earlier this year and in the last year or so. We think as long as liquidity conditions remain tight, and remember, the Fed is still raising rates. They may slow the pace, but they're still raising rates. And we've got quantitative tightening, which is double the pace of what we saw in 2018. Plus, we have rate hikes going globally, with the exception of maybe Japan, China. And so these tightening liquidity conditions tend to support the dollar. The dollar is the world's funding currency. So yes, you've seen this sell-off, this technical profit-taking, if you will, on the dollar in recent months, but we don't think we've seen a major dollar top along the lines of what we saw in 1970, 85, the early 2000s. Maybe we're going to be in a bit more of a range over the coming months as we play through this tug-of-war of China reopening and central banks. How much will they tighten? But we don't think we've seen a sustained turn yet.
Rebecca, where do you have the terminal rate at the Federal Reserve?
Well, we're not trying to predict specific numbers for the stock market or the Fed funds. We're trying to understand the degree of pressures on the economy that's going to translate into market outcomes. But certainly, if we need to see wage inflation, which by the Atlanta Fed's measure is still running well over 6%, if we need to get that down 2 or 3 percentage points to get U.S. inflation closer to the Fed's target, then I think we're going to see the Fed going at least to 5% on the Fed funds, with a probability that's not de minimis that they may have to go higher. The trick is, if they get to the spring sometime and maybe pause to give time for Fed hiking so far to play through the economy, maybe inflation comes down to 3-4%. But if the Fed's not happy with that, then they may have to do an additional round of tightening. And we saw that before in the 1970s and early 80s. You needed 3 rounds of tightening for the Fed to actually get inflation under control. The market absolutely is not discounting that possibility. We're not saying it's our base case, but it's certainly a risk that we think is something people should consider.
Your base case sounds like 5. Is that fair? From what I just heard there, is 5 fair?
I think 5 is certainly plausible,
okay.
and it is very possible we could go higher than that.
So 5's the base case. That's largely what's been priced in the market for quite a while, largely expecting the Federal Reserve to put that in their projections next week. Rebecca, I think a lot of people might sit here and say, well, that's priced. We're done mm-hmm. with that. And to get that extra leg of dollar strength, I need something else. And Rebecca, I guess the question is, what is it in your base case that delivers that something else?
I try not to interrupt you because I'm dying to answer the question.
Sure.
It's easy. What's not priced is the Fed going high and holding. The market's anticipating right now that we get significant rate cuts starting in the second half of next year. And we think without severe economic weakness to justify that, we're going to get the Fed pausing but not cutting. And so as that is changed in what the discounted, what the market is discounting, we think that could add a layer of support to the dollar. Again, don't forget, we're not talking about an end of quantitative tightening or rate hikes around the world as well.
You know, I just want to point out, Ms. Patterson never is dying to interrupt me. It's only you she is dying to interrupt.
You think that's, why do you think that is?
Because, you know, I don't know. I'm just not getting it going.
See, to be fair, though, it's a good response about the persistence of the Fed staying there and holding
pushing back
against this view that we get these rate cuts from the Federal Reserve anytime soon.
Rebecca and I remember when you made a 6-month call. If you were really, you know, an 18-month call was strange. Now we're going to pivot in January, in the fourth week of February, we're going to pivot again, and then by the first week of April, we're going to do this. Forget about it. Rebecca, cash is trash. What is the value of cash to our listeners and viewers into 2023?
Well, what's so interesting, Tom, is that we're really seeing the market move into a new paradigm. We haven't had short-term rates this high in a very long time. And so it is interesting to think about how our investors are going to position for the next decade versus the last decade. The last decade was all about low and stable inflation, low macro volatility, low commodity prices. And now if we're in a regime where there's more uncertainty around the level of inflation, more uncertainty around where interest rates should settle, what's the right portfolio to construct? Should you stay overweight the U.S.? Should you stay overweight tech? How much private assets should you have in your portfolio? We think there's some tectonic plates that are shifting right now, and assuming that they can be sustained, and we think there's a real chance they can, I think we're going to get a lot of more structural, bigger market changes, portfolio allocation changes in the year or two ahead as people realize this is a different world we're moving into. Not that inflation is going to settle at 4 or 5, but it certainly could settle higher than where it's been, with rates higher than they've been as well.
Got to squeeze this in. This is great, Rebecca. Just one final question. What's the biggest change that you're expecting that so far the conversations that you're having with clients, they're pushing back on still? What's the number one change you think we're going to see?
Well, I think the structural change is inflation. I think the cyclical change, the biggest thing to watch for 2023 is growth. I think we're going to have to see growth weaker for central banks to hit their targets, and that's not yet reflected in earnings.
Rebecca Patterson, thank you.
Brilliant.
Bridgewater, just fantastic.
As we celebrate, and I mean truly celebrate, accidental conflict, America-China, and the clash of false narratives. This, of course, was Stephen Roach. You've heard me in the recent days say essentially he invented modern market economics at Morgan Stanley and, of course, now at his Yale University. Dr. Roach, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I do want to ask one American a question before we celebrate your informative book, and that is simply, do we hearken back to the fears of the 60s and the 70s and a wage-price spiral?
Well, the wage-price spiral back then, Tom, was heavily impacted by cost of living indexation clauses in labor union contracts. And two things have happened. Labor unions are a much smaller share of the workforce, and these COLA adjustment clauses are less prevalent than they were back then. And nevertheless, you know, wages are, labor is a very important segment of overall business costs, and tight labor markets are certainly boosting the compensation piece of that, and weak productivity is reinforcing it. So it's important to stay focused on this issue.
Stephen Roach, to China, Sir Howard Davies mentions of your book that it is a way to a new framework, a new discussion of both parties. We need goodwill among United States and China. How do we find that goodwill?
Well, number one, we have to recognize that the current approach that we've both been wedded to over the past 20 years is an abysmal failure. In the last 5 years, we've had the beginnings of a trade war, a tech war, and now the early stages of a new Cold War. So in accidental conflict, I propose a new approach based on three key pillars. Rebuilding trust by going after the low-hanging fruits of reopening consulates and restarting exchange programs, taking pressure off of NGOs. Secondly, abandoning the zero-sum bilateral trade framework, which makes no sense and has not worked at all, embracing a market-opening pro-growth initiative framed around a bilateral investment treaty. And thirdly, making an effort to establish a new architecture for engagement. These summits like the one that Xi Jinping and Joe Biden had on November 14th, they're long on photo ops, but they accomplished nothing. I'm in favor of a new full-time organization that I call a U.S.-China Secretariat, which is detailed in the book.
But after the Party Congress, and what we see from the leadership in Beijing, a leadership perhaps forever, is the idea, as you mentioned in one of your chapters, a China with American characteristics. There seems to be zero desire for that out of Beijing.
Well, China wants to do it its way, and that's been an affront to us. We had this rather naive presumption that we'd let China into the WTO. They would play by our rules and become more like us. They had the facade of presenting that similar appearance, but they've certainly gone their own way, and that remains a worrisome part of the ongoing conflict.
Steve, you live this. I mean, some would say with you the next Asia, you actually were the first one to write about this within market economics. You're sitting with James Gorman now having a cup of coffee. Does Morgan Stanley move from Hong Kong to Singapore?
Well, I'm no longer employed by that firm where I worked for 30 years, so I'll leave that up to them to comment on. But certainly Singapore has benefited a lot from the shifts that have occurred in Hong Kong. But Hong Kong, to its credit, is trying to reclaim its position as a major financial center in non-Japan Asia, and we'll see if they can pull it off.
How do you react to the bipartisan nature of this in Washington, Steve? I mean, it's one of the very, very few ideas in Washington where there seems to be common ground. And, you know, there were waves of this going from Chiang Kai-shek and back to World War II, 1947, and all. Is this just another wave of bipartisan anti-China feeling, or is there a permanence to this?
Well, it's politically expedient for the U.S. to do it. I mean, the sentiment is virtually the only thing, as you said, Tom, that's unanimous within the Republican and Democratic ranks. And it's going to be hard to dislodge. One of the big surprises for me was the election of Joe Biden, if anything, has not altered the Trump anti-China policies. If anything, it's amplified it. And for a president who repudiated so much of his predecessors' unpopular policies like the border wall and the Muslim travel ban to perpetuate what I think is a wrong-footed U.S.-China policy is a disappointment and a surprise.
Tim Cook reads Accidental Conflicts, Stephen Roach. What does he do? I mean, what is the approach for multinational Americans led by Apple in China?
Well, you know, Tim Cook's been leading the way in reevaluating the commitment of U.S.-based multinationals to a full outsourcing bet in China. Apple is obviously the quintessential a producer who's taken advantage of this production platform in Guangdong province. And they're now, for a variety of reasons, understandable, but right. The conflict is part of it, starting to diversify production of the iPhone into India slowly. But that's a move that needs to be watched very carefully for the future.
With all of your experience, do you have a confidence they can get manufacturing process in other nations equal to what they've invented in China?
Well, I think China certainly has made a huge bet in terms of revamping its infrastructure and equipping its companies and workers with the latest in technical skills and new technologies. But by no means does it have a monopoly on that opportunity. And you know, that's what globalization does. It offers similar opportunities for other offshore low-cost production platforms.
Stephen, in the time that I've got left, I think we need to talk about one of your calls, and you've been very, very candid about this, and the idea of weak dollar. Well, guess what? It's been a Steve Roach quarter. We had a resilient dollar, and finally, there's a new weakness with international investment doing better with that weak dollar. Is this the great Roachian turn?
Well, I don't know how great that is for me, because it was one of my more humiliating forecasts. I promised myself
we've had a few, right?
Yeah, I've had a few, but this was a bad one. It's very much tied to the Fed. As I look back on the mistake that I made, I think it was a fair mistake to make at the time, because the Fed a couple of years ago showed no desire to be aggressive to tighten monetary policy to counter what it incorrectly presumed was a transitory inflation. The Fed's gotten religion, and now as it is nearing not so much a pivot, but a sort of a second derivative slowing in the rate of rate hikes, some of the bid has come off the dollar, but the dollar is still a good deal higher than it was when I made that seemingly dumb call.
Well, Stephen, let me finish up with the optimism of Accidental Conflict as well. Where do you want to be in 12 months? I mean, short term for the Chinese, and frankly, short term for America as well. What is the to-do list that we need to do to get to the goodwill Howard Davies talks about?
We need to re-engage. There is absolutely not anyone in our political structure, Republicans and Democrats alike, especially in leadership roles, who's willing to make a bet in reengaging with the Chinese. There's a lot of things about China that are uncomfortable and unpleasant that we have focused on. But the two most powerful economies, the two superpowers, need a more constructive framework of engagement. And I propose that in the book with a very optimistic final chapter on this new plan.
You have to leave it there. Stephen Roach, thank you so much and congratulations on decades of work on the thinking of America and China.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Gabriel Matlof is with the Bank of Ireland. He is their governor. And can you imagine, folks, in America, if basically the Federal Reserve System to find a new chairman went out and did a worldwide search? That's what the Bank of Ireland did with some controversy. The British economist of type moving from New Zealand to Ireland, and we're thrilled that the governor could join us this morning. Governor, what is the biggest challenge that Christine Lagarde has just in the coming 90 days?
Well, Christine, and the thank you for having me, firstly, thank you for describing me as the most interesting person, but that's for a separate discussion. I think Christine and all the members of the Governing Council are facing the sorts of challenges that I think many people across Europe, if not the world, are facing, which is dealing with some extreme uncertainty. Well, I know we've been talking about that for a while. But the combination of the recovery from the pandemic, the supply chain problems that we've had, the news about China that I've just heard you talk about, the ongoing Russian war in Ukraine, and so on, we have a constellation of issues that we have to navigate through to arrive at the right monetary policy for the euro area. So it's a challenge.
Governor, one of the great challenges, and I would note Ireland's leadership in growth for whatever reason is debatable, but the fact is it's been a growth engine, everything said and done. Governor, one of the distinctions here is a belief in the strength, the technology, the nominal GDP of America versus a lesser nominal GDP in Europe. Do you push against that? Do you say we underestimate the potential of European growth forward?
I absolutely do. I think the potential there is huge. It's already a very, very big economy, and it's ambitious for itself. So I think, and technology is going to be a critical platform for the future. You know, digitalization, climate change, and demography are the big economic transitions that we're all going through right now. And I think Europe is has the potential to be at the head of all of those, actually.
Let's talk about the reality of the decision, Governor, that you face on December 15th. Can I just start with your base case? Does it include a recession in the Eurozone economy now?
I haven't seen the ECB staff's forecasts, which we're going to see next week. But my own view is that we're likely to see the euro area in a technical recession. I suspect that Q4 this year, the one that we're in now, we'll see a very slightly negative GDP number, and we're likely to see that for Q1 next year. On the other hand, my expectation is we're not going to see 2023 as a year of recession.
Governor, with that in mind, how does that influence your view of how much tightening we ultimately need?
Well, in my view, we started the normalization of interest rates. People have forgotten that back in June we were in negative rate territory, and we're definitely not there now. But I also think that next week when we meet, I think a 50 basis point increase is the sort of floor that we should be discussing. I expect us to go there, but I don't expect us to end there. I do expect us to continue in future meetings.
Have you now, got an idea, Governor, of how far you would push that?
I was about to say, how far I will push that will very much depend on the data and seeing where the projections are telling us, seeing what the latest data are telling us. But I think in my view, it's pretty clear that with inflation running at 10%, our target at 2%, core inflation at 5%, I think it's pretty clear that next week's decision won't be the last increase that we make.
Interest rate policy, only one part of this, of course. We've also got to talk about the unwind of the balance sheet. Can you update us on how discussions are going, how your thoughts are evolving on what we should be doing with a balance sheet that large at the ECB and how you would prefer to unwind it?
I mean, my preference is to unwind it. I think the reasons for having it in the first place, the very long period of low rates and the risk of deflation, those reasons are gone. So we now need to look to unwind it. My view is that it needs to be done cautiously and carefully and predictably. So my preference would be for us to start slowly, leave ourselves the room for accelerating if we feel it's warranted, but to do it in that order. I expect us to set out at or to agree at the next week's meeting a set of principles which the president will for winding the balance sheet down, which the president will announce. I don't expect anything to start until next year. My own preference would be something towards the end of Q1, beginning of Q2. Right.
Governor, so important here is your experience in New Zealand, where there's been a real idea of rules of the road in central banking. I think they've provided decades of leadership on that. Olivier Blanchard and others are talking about a set above 2% in America. Combine your New Zealand experience with the idea that we may not bring inflation down to the comfort level, the anchored level of decades of theory. Can we live in America or in Europe with a higher inflation set? Let's use America as an example of near 3%. Can we live with that? Can there be a permanence to that?
Well, at the ECB, we had a review of our strategy like the Fed did before us. Which we concluded last in July 21, and we concluded that 2% inflation should be the target that we focus on and aim for. There's been no discussion within the Governing Council as to whether or not that target should be changed, and I don't expect it to. That should remain our focus. On the other hand, I am interested in the debates that academics and others are having, and it's interesting to observe. Part of this is about, in my view anyway, part of this is about communication. So in New Zealand, the target was actually a range between 1 to 3%, with the midpoint being So it's about how you communicate and then explain what you're doing.
Right.
But for the moment, the ECB is absolutely focused on 2% right. in the medium term.
Is England communicating in the World Cup?
I think the English team have got an excellent chance to win the World Cup. One of the challenges, you mentioned Christine Lagarde has to maneuver over the coming weeks is making sure that all the members of the governing council who are supporting different teams can be managed appropriately.
I'm not sure how your Irish colleagues might feel
does
about
she, what scarf
about
does Madame Lagarde wear here? I mean, what is the signal that we're going to see
15th.
Into December 18th?
I imagine there might be some French pride going on there, Tom.
There might be some French pride there.
Governor, wonderful to catch up with you, sir. Let's do this again soon. Governor McLeod there of the Bank
of
Ireland.
I'd like to do this in Dublin. I mean, I've been saying this
Why is there always a trip involved with you?
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.